a series, a two-part series, as we often do. So for today and for next week, we'll try to divide this into two parts. There'll be another source sheet next week. And this is something that I think is a little bit different style, topic, and focus than we typically do. But, you know, I think within the broad range of the type of things that we like to study, you know, for those of us who were together last year, there was some number of the series, mini-series in Shurim that we did that were uniquely women-focused. And then a lot of them were more broadly, you know, the laws of benching, the laws of lots of things. Of course, we discussed in each context how they related to women, but they were broad topics, not necessarily the kind of topics exclusively that would have been in a seminary course catalog that began with women and. But we tried to do some of those. And in fact, last year, Dafka, when we did one or two of those, the feedback I got was some people, Dafka, wanted more of them. So I guess it's been a while since people were in seminary, so they like a little bit of a refresher. But anyway, be that as it may, the last 2 weeks we studied both from hashkafa and a halacha perspective, the focus on women and davening. The halachic part was specifically focused on women and daily davening. We didn't discuss tefillah b'tzibur, we didn't discuss Shabbos and Yontif, and I think there's interest that perhaps in the future we'll give a shiur about that. But for these 2 weeks, something that I've actually never given shiur on, and therefore it was a good opportunity for myself to look into the topic, and that is the famous triplet of Chala, Neros, or Hadlakas Aner, and Nida, the three mitzvos that are uniquely associated with women. And what I thought we would do, both from a hashkafa and a little bit from a halachic perspective, the next 2 weeks, is try to understand some of the primary sources that deal with these three as a unit. In what ways there are common thread between these three? Why are they in any way uniquely connected to women, etc.? As well as then try to discuss each of them on their own terms, some of the halachos and some of the ways in which there is unique connections to women and unique significance to those mitzvot. Now, the unique significance is not only, although I hope to show that it is, but it is not only in a positive and inspiring way. Unique significance could also be synonymously formulated as unique severity, which is pretty much we're going to have to start off. I don't like starting off always so harsh, if you will, but literally the first source we're going to see, which is the most famous source, is quite severe. You know, this is a grown-up and mature crowd, and I don't hide things from you. We believe in the Masorah, but not every text is easiest to digest as every other, if we're being honest with ourselves. This is a topic which will have various different sources, some of which are a little bit harsher, I guess is maybe the term I would use, and some of which perhaps are a little bit more positive and inspiring. So with that introduction, one tiny word of introduction to really segue, and that is that usually when we think of mitzvos, typically, we either think of the category of mitzvos in which men and women are equally obligated, or we typically then think of the mitzvos in which women are not obligated. And last year, actually, one of the series that we had last year, we did a two-part series last year on mitzvot aseh shezman grama, the whys, the whats, why are they exempt? What does it mean to be exempt? Are you allowed to do the mitzvos? Can you make a bracha on the mitzvos? Could you do a mitzvah on behalf of a man? All sorts of discussions, very, very interesting discussion. But this topic, this unit, presents us with a third model, which is mitzvos, which are maybe to some extent relevant to men as well, which we'll see they certainly are. And yet, it's absolutely clear that there's a strong and explicit precedence and preference given to women, not only to perform those mitzvos, but a responsibility above and beyond what a man would have, or in some cases, the appropriate, you'd say, the husband would have. These are mitzvos that are specific. So this is a really unique category in that regard. And I think if we think about, let's say, mitzvos more writ large, I think we appreciate it. Because I say, subconsciously, we either think of mitzvos generically, or we think of mitzvos as women are not obligated or disadvantaged. And here we have literally the opposite. It's a much more an emphasis specifically on women. Okay, so now that I've delayed enough, I guess I can't. Now we need to get into the actual source. And the famous source I'm referring to, again, the one that's a little bit harsh to the ears if you haven't yet heard it, but it's the most famous, is the Mishnah. There's actually a lesser known Gemara, which we'll discuss as well. But it's really a Mishnah, which is quoted in Masechet Shabbos. It's the first line on your source sheet. It's underlined. Source number one from Masechet Shabbos. The Mishnah says as follows. Al shalosh aveiros, noshim mesos b'shas leidasan. So there you have it. There are three mitzvos in which women are I guess you could say we're just trying to translate this as simply as we could, uniquely culpable that, obviously the intent here is, if they're not careful in observing these three mitzvos, they will be punished by dying during childbirth. Right. That's our introduction to these three mitzvos. Not something very beautiful and inspiring. There's no harps in the background. It's, you'll die during childbirth. Welcome to Judaism. She'en and Zahiros Benida, if a woman is not careful in the laws of Nida. Number two, Chala. Number three, Hadlakas Haner, which usually is understood to be Shabbos and Yontif. Now, one important definitional term, which is absolutely necessary for understanding how this comes up the rest of this year. When we say Chala, we don't mean necessarily the thing that lots of women, not all, no pressure, but lots of women love to do or take pride in making challah for Shabbos, and they have a braid, and oh, it's very cool to do cinnamon and onion challah and all that, chocolate chip challah, all that stuff. It shares the same name, but it's not the same thing. Challah, in a halachic context, specifically refers to baking bread, but that's not necessarily anything to do with Shabbos, certainly nothing to do with like cinnamon or braiding or anything like that. It specifically refers to the fact that if you would bake enough, and it doesn't even have to be bread, but could even be types of cakes or things like that. That's a discussion of what consistency it would have to be. But let's for now just say easily, any kind of bread, nothing to do with Shabbos at all, if you bake a certain volume of that, you need to take off a certain part of that, and in the Torah's conception, give that to the Kohen. This is one of the gifts you give to the Kohen, like Truma, like Bikurim, things like that. This is one of the gifts you give a Kohen. Now, because everyone's Tameh, and you can't give a, you can't do the mitzvah of challah when we're Tameh, so you know that we just burn or dispose of that little symbolic part of challah. But that's what it means, challah. Now, typically, nowadays, the only time women are ever separating challah is when they're baking challah. Understood. But just to understand that that's just convention. That has nothing to do with halacha. Halachically, you could be baking something that is, you know, very flat or very round and not braided at all and got nothing to do with Shabbos. But if you baked a certain amount, you would have had to have given that to the Kohen, or even nowadays, you'd separate that. It's that idea that there's a small amount that has to be separated to the Kohen, that's called challah. So these are the three mitzvos that says the Mishnah. Again, if we were just to paraphrase this, again, not denying what the Mishnah says, but just kind of lower the temperature a little bit, again, we would paraphrase this and say women have unique responsibility for these mitzvos. And evidently, the stakes are quite high if they're not observed. Now, the reason I keep on emphasizing unique responsibility is because the truth is, in all three of these, they're not completely disconnected from men, right? Obviously, if a husband and wife are together and they haven't been careful in the laws of Nida, they're both culpable. It's not if you actually violate the laws of Nida, it's not only the wife that would be punished, only the woman that would be punished. Both husband and wife, according to the Torah, have the punishment of kares. So we have to understand why are we... This Mishnah is not denying that. This is like some other level. That there's some, despite the fact, or in addition to that, some unique potential culpability for the wife above her husband. Similarly for challah. Right? It doesn't matter. A man is not allowed to eat any dough. Let me put it in the negative. Just like you can't process or harvest as a farmer any of the crops until you've already given to the Kohen the Truma. Anyone remember what's, if you haven't yet, before you've given away the gifts to the Kohen, what is that called? Tevel. Right? Until you've, and Tevel is a very specific, Misa Bidei Shamayim. So a man's not allowed to eat Tevel just like a woman's not allowed to eat Tevel. So, and yet, apparently according to our Mishnah, there's still an added emphasis on the woman. And of course, Hadlakas Haner, or I should say, of course, that's maybe the one that people will know the least about. But, as we mentioned last year also, we had a two-part series last year on Hadlakas Neros, and we emphasized then, and we'll repeat it again a little bit today, and it might come up again next week's year, the family, the house, is obligated in Neros Shabbos. Which is why, some of you may know, if a man is away from his wife or something like that, or if the wife is away traveling, for example, like my wife's in America this week, it's not the first time, it happens at least once every year, I light Shabbos candles. And in theory, even my wife and I were both at home, but she couldn't, she was too busy, something distracted her, or she didn't feel well and couldn't get out of bed, so I would light candles. Candles are not uniquely or exclusively, maybe it's a better way to put it, candles are not exclusively obligatory on a woman, they're obligatory on the home. And yet, from this source and many others when it comes to Neros, we know that, nevertheless, women are given a precedence. So we have to try to understand what is going on here, because none of these are mitzvos which are completely irrelevant to men. And again, especially in the first two, if there would be a transgression, the transgression, the punishment would be just the same for men and for women. And yet, the Mishnah is clearly introducing us to some extra level of responsibility and therefore culpability for women. Okay, so far so good? Or not so good, but at least understood? Okay, great. So, end of the first line, the Gemara. This is right away the Gemara. This is a little bit of a weird Gemara. But I felt like, given that the Gemara does discuss this, how could, before we run to all the Mefarshim or parallel sources, how could we not at least see the Gemara's discussion? So let's do this together. The Gemara right away, at the end of the first line, asks the obvious question. I mean, there's multiple questions that we've asked and might be running through your mind. But for the Gemara, the most obvious question is, why is there such a severe punishment? What is so, you know, again, above and beyond what the Torah already told us? What's going on here? So the Gemara, for whatever reason, picks specifically on Nida. It'll eventually get to the other two, but the Gemara starts with Nida. Nida my taima. What is so bad that if a woman doesn't take responsibility for the laws of Nida, she will be punished? Amar of Yitzhak, second line. He kilkala bechadre bitna, lefilkach tilke bechadre bitna. Kind of a, I wouldn't say esoteric or mystical, but a little bit of an obscure way of kind of a mida keneged mida. That is to say, she was not taking care of the halachos that emerge from her womb, the uterine blood. So therefore, in a process in which, of course, the uterus is opening during childbirth, which we know is objectively very, very dangerous, mida keneged mida, that's where she'll be punished. Now, she, and obviously in a severe way. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. So the Gemara says, okay, well, even if somehow I would accept that, Tenach Nida, I understand Nida. What's that got to do with the other two? Chalav hadlaka saner ma'ika lemeimar. Right, you know, Nida, blood, life, you know, I didn't care, you know, blood is, and the uterine blood is, you know, and the egg is the source potentially of life, so if I wasn't careful with that halacha, so maybe there's some real high stakes in that. But Chala, you know, Nida, candles, what's going on there? So the Gemara says, in reformulating this, again, this is not every Gemara is this kind of obtuse, but this is, or almost esoteric, but this Gemara is Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, third line. God, so to speak, says, Revius Dam Nasati Bechem Al Iske Dam Hizarti Bechem. There's a Gemara, again, I don't know that this is necessarily scientific, but the Gemara has a principle in other places that a person would need, well, we know this part is true, a minimum amount of blood to stay alive, right? If, God forbid, someone had a lot, severe blood loss, they could die from that. So the Gemara refers to that minimum amount as a revius. Revius is not to gross you out, but that's like the minimum amount you need to have in a Kiddush cup, just to give you some sense of proportion, not to be thinking about that on Friday night. That's not our religion. That's a different religion. But that, since you need some kind of minimum amount of blood to live, Dam hua nefesh, you know, there's a lot of different sources that would indicate something like that, aside from the fact that it's basically a scientific fact. So therefore, since a woman is not being careful about the dam that is her life source, so therefore, she will lose her life. That is the first answer when it comes to Nida. Okay, well, what about then the other two? So look at the next line. Reshit karati etchem. Al iske reshit hisharti etchem. The Pasuk, I think it's in the name of Yirmiyah, if I remember correctly, refers metaphorically, poetically, refers to the Jewish people as like the first crop, the Reshit. It's one of the poetic ways or euphemistic ways of referring to us as the Am HaNivchar, the chosen nation. So we're the Reshit. Similarly, when the Torah describes the mitzvah of challah, again, not the braiding thing that they do like, you know, in South Africa before they do their big, you know, Shabbos to save the world or 20,000 women and all that. But specifically, the little thing that you could give a Kohen, that challah, that mitzvah is referred to it as reishis in the Torah. That's the term is used in the Torah, reishis arisa sechem. Okay? So therefore, there's a parallelism, and therefore, if you didn't take care of your reishis, the challah, so therefore, so to speak, since Jewish people are considered the righteous, some of you forfeited your right to life. And lastly, again, a little bit hard to understand, admittedly. And then lastly, what about the candles? Neshama shenasati bechem kriyaner. We know that very famous, this we all know very metaphorically, right? That's why we light yahrzeit candles and the like, that the ner Hashem nishmas Adam, right? The candle, the ner, is considered a metaphor for the soul for life. Therefore, I gave you a neshama, which is compared to a candle. Aliskeiner hizarti bechem, and therefore you're responsible. excuse me, for keeping this flame alive. Shabbos and Yom Tov candles. Im atem mekayim moso mutav. If you light the Shabbos candles, Yom Tov candles, great. excuse me, I'm taking, you don't light the candle, I'm taking away the candle, so to speak, of your life. Now, just to be clear, aside from the fact that all this is a little bit hard to understand, a little esoteric, we have also not in any way, other than maybe Nida, which is somewhat more intuitive, maybe, but certainly with the other two, we have in no way even broached, let alone sufficiently answered, why this should be uniquely on women. That has not even been brought up in the Gemara. Here the Gemara is just saying, why is it so bad? And even then, the Gemara's answers are a little bit hard to decipher. So we're going to get to that. I don't want you to think I missed it or I'm trying to hide it from you. The Gemara itself seems to ignore that. Last but not least, what would be the third question one could ask on the Gemara? Not only why is it so severe, not only why are these things uniquely on women, but even if we would accept all of those, the Gemara didn't just say, God forbid, if a woman's not careful, then she would die. The Gemara made the threat, I guess you could say, or the warning, very specific, namely, during childbirth. So the Gemara, in the last line of the Gemara, this is the end of the Gemara, asks the question, why dafka that? So the Gemara answers with a number. I actually didn't give you the whole Gemara. That's the ellipse of three dots. There's a few more statements in the Gemara, but they're all variations of the theme in which various Amoraim, various rabbis in the Talmud, give metaphoric or parables for the following principles. So what's just the first example is the one I gave you. Amarava nafultura chadala sakina. It's as if that was like some popular idiom back in the day. If the ox falls, sharpen the knife. You understand, right? No. What am I talking about? Of course you don't understand. How can anyone understand? What are we talking about? Right? Just for the record, if I ever wanted to make sure you had no interest in ever learning Gemara again, maybe I did that, right? I'm not necessarily motivated to do that. I'm not necessarily against women learning. But I'm just saying, if I was, this might have been the first Gemara I would teach you, and then you'd be like, okay, the men can have it. Right? Riddles and other things. What is it talking about? And again, there's four or five other riddles that come after this. The basic idea being, you want to get the ox on the ground if you're going to shecht it. And the hardest thing to do is to get it on the ground and hold it down. So Rabbah says it was like popular advice back in the day, the kind of thing like, you know, your bubby would have always said, you know, my Zadie always said, you know, when the ox falls down, sharpen the knife. You know, that's what they say, right? And who doesn't say that? The idea being, once you it's an opportune time when it's already down, take advantage of the opportunity. That's the idiom. And there's a lot of different, you know, various other ways of saying it. Namely, that is to say, it's true, of course, if God forbid God wanted to punish any one of us, he doesn't need an excuse and he doesn't need help. We can get hit by a car tomorrow, we can not wake up tomorrow, it doesn't need anything else. But the way Hashem runs the world, all things being equal, the more objectively dangerous situation we are already in, it's easier to just, you know, quickly, you know, with a little bit of an oomph, you know, knock us off, as opposed to if we're otherwise in a safe situation. So it seems to be, again, what the Gemara is trying to say, this is the impression you get. Huh?
Sounds like a horrible mashal limshal, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Well, again, just let me make the point, and then I'm happy to hear your objection, as long as I'm being clear. Maybe I wasn't. That is to say, since, as we all know, childbirth is objectively dangerous, again, we are all fortunate to live at a time in human history where it is the safest it's ever been. I don't get the statistics wrong, but for much of human history, not a small percentage of births ended in tragedy. So Hodul Hashem Kitov that we live in a time where it's incredibly, not unheard of. I think I mentioned once in a previous year, when I was growing up, there was one case where I grew up in Cincinnati where a woman died in childbirth in the Frum community. But incredibly, the reason I remember that is because I've never heard of it since. Right? Incredibly, incredibly, incredibly rare. But historically and objectively and halachically, as you know, halachically, Ara Yom Hazeh, we consider a woman who's in childbirth in a sakana, where machal Shabbos for her, all sorts of things. There's the Birkas HaGomel that many are accustomed to say. So childbirth is objectively and halachically dangerous. So since a woman is already in a dangerous situation, if anyway she was deserving death, that's going to make the most sense when Hashem would, quote-unquote, knock her off. That's what you get the impression of from the Gemara. Rashi, I figured Rashi would just spell that out explicitly. Unless I missed it, I didn't see Rashi say anything. But in source number two, the Bartanura, who's a commentary on the Mishnah, and again, this is a Gemara that was all based on the Mishnah, so the Bartanura adds this and makes this point explicitly. B'shas sakana muzumun l'paranusa. Once anyway you're in a dangerous situation, it's easy for Hashem to just, you know, push you a little bit over the edge. And just in case you're wondering, I didn't put this on the sheet because it's not relevant for our topic, but the very next lines in the Gemara asks, well, what about men? Now, the Gemara is not saying, the Gemara never gets to, oh yeah, these three mitzvahs, these four mitzvahs, these six mitzvahs are specifically obligatory on men, and therefore if they don't do those, it's not. There's no direct parallel. But the assumption that, of course, a man could do something wrong and be deserving of death, that's obvious, and that Hashem might want to punish him and knock a man off in a dangerous time when anyway he's at risk, so why not just push him over the edge? That the Gemara assumes is true just about men as it is for women. And the Gemara actually then asks the question, well, if a man anyway is deserving of death, when is Hashem going to knock him off? And the Gemara says, well, when he's crossing a bridge. Because, you know, especially in the olden days, bridges were very rickety and very dangerous. And then the Gemara says, well, what about, you know, bridge is the only way. And then the Gemara basically says, well, if he's doing anything that's like crossing a bridge. Basically, another way of saying anything that's dangerous. Which is, by the way, and I'm happy to take any questions, comments, or objections in a moment. I don't know if I can prove it to you, but I am convinced, especially based on the continuation of the Gemara, that this idea of b'shas leidasan should not be, I don't know if this is good or bad, but I just think it's true, so I'm going to tell you, I don't think it's meant to be taken literally. That is to say, first of all, for example, not lighting Shabbos candles, that's not a capital offense. I don't think the Gemara is saying you're chayiv misa. There's clearly some spiritual, moral message that the Gemara is going to try to give to us, which we have to decipher. But the idea, you know, no one would say, you know, if two witnesses came and I saw that for 3 weeks in a row she didn't light Shabbos candles. No, you're not chayiv misa. But more than that, I also think it's clear the Gemara doesn't mean literally, and therefore you can assume, take it to the bank, she's going to die during childbirth. Now, first of all, because that would make no sense for quite a while now where almost nobody dies during childbirth. Does that mean no one ever was guilty of any of these averos? I think it means more broadly, like the Gemara eventually says explicitly when it comes to men, again, in those days, by far and away, the most dangerous thing a woman would do was have a baby, right? Especially if you assume that they didn't necessarily work. They probably, who knows how many times they were leaving their house or leaving their little village. They weren't going to war. What objectively dangerous things were women doing in the ancient world? So the one that was by far the most common, the most dangerous, was childbirth. And the Gemara is clearly saying, as the Bar Tanur explains, as the Gemara explains with all these euphemisms in the continuation, when you're in any way in a dangerous situation, again, it's not something unique to childbirth, and it's not something, there's no unique connection. Again, despite the fact that the Gemara talks about unique connection between women and these three things, but there's no unique, the Gemara never says there's any unique connection between childbirth. So I don't think that's intended to be taken literally, God forbid. And I also don't know if the whole Gemara is meant to be taken literally. We're not saying this is chayiv misa in a halachic context. That's clearly not true. Although it is true, and I said this before, it is true that about two of the three, Nida and Chala, again, Chala in the time of the Gemara, in the Mishnah in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, that those were very, very severe. But those were severe for men and for women. Right? If a husband and wife are together and you're not going to the mikvah, that's an Isser Kares for the man and the woman. And if you eat tevel, food that was not untithed, that's misa bidei shamayim, for the man and the woman, and the children, and anyone who eats it. So in that sense, again, I think there's clearly a message that the Gemara is trying to convey, but it's not, I don't think, intended to be taken literally in that sense. Okay, do you have, now that help or not? It's allowed to not.
No, you said what I thought.
Okay.
I just was saying, like, it just sounds horrible to compare, like, an ox down and what you think, and then...
Right. I get it. I agree with you. I don't disagree with you. Again, it's maybe easier for me as the one man in the room to say, but I just would rather look at it as like, wow, Hodul Hashem Kitov. Like, we don't live in that world anymore. Like, for, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't want to get it wrong, but, you know, years, again, women still, to their great heroic credit, not only in the Jewish community, in the whole world, people were having babies anyway. But they knew every time they went into labor that this was, you know, that dangerous. Right? Thank God we don't live in that world. We don't associate it. Again, there's some level of risk, and some people have more high-risk pregnancies, and again, Nebuch, sometimes we do hear about serious situations. But they're so rare, thank God, because of the time in which we live. Now, I will just mention one technical point when it comes to the Shabbos candles, because I mentioned that's, in a certain way, that's the hardest one to understand. Because there's no halachic source anywhere that talks about Shabbos candles being so severe, so machmir, that there's karei, smisa. Forget the childbirth death thing. That's obvious. I mean, that's can't be, I don't think, taken literally, or doesn't mean it that halachically you're culpable on that level. But again, as we mentioned, at least with Nida or Chala, in Shamayim, these are considered very severe capital offenses. But that's not true about Shabbos candles. So the answer may be, again, that this is yet another proof that the Gemara is not meant to be taken literally. But I did see one interpretation at source number three, the Rashash. I don't know if any of you were ever, Rav Shalom Tarshan, any of you ever gone on a Jewish history tour of Vilna? Have you ever been to Vilna? So I went twice to to Poland to go to the camps, once as a madrich with yeshiva guys and once as a madrich with seminary girls. And actually, I think it was on the yeshiva trip that we actually spent the day in Vilna. Most of those kind of trips don't go to Vilna because there's no camps near Vilna. Worked out that we flew there, had our first day in Vilna, and then we started going to the other part of Poland, not Jewish life, but Jewish death. That was the rest of that trip. Anyway, if you go to Vilna, part of anyone's Jewish history tour nowadays, they will talk about the Rashash. He was a very, very wealthy banker in Vilna, who was also a massive Talmud Chacham. And in fact, the most universally accepted printing of the Gemaras, which we still use today, are known as the Vilna Shas. He was the financier behind them. When he died, he donated his massive library to the community. A very, very well-known person. Anyway, he has little comments on almost every page of the Gemara, and they're in the back of most published Gemara books. And he says there, in source number three, clearly he's bothered by what's going on with the Shabbos candles. Like, there's no way that's a chayv misa in any way. So he says, again, it's not really the simple understanding of the Gemara, but he says the Gemara is not talking about a woman who didn't light Shabbos candles. Rather, Einan is a heroes b'hadlakas hanermi ba'od yom u'machalos as a Shabbos. He's talking about, says the Gemara, it says Rashash, the Gemara's talking about, a woman who lights, but she's not careful about when she lights. So she's missing shkia, and she's lighting after dark, or she's lighting when the lighting itself is chil Shabbos. Right? If you light a fire on Shabbos, that's one of the lamitas malachos. You can't do that. So I don't know, this might be better and worse. Meaning, again, very, very infrequent, I would hope that, that's why we have 18 minutes, we create a buffer, and then the very next Mishnah in Masechta Shabbos says the husband's responsibility to remind his wife if she's running late, and other poskim say a man should also help. You should just know, by the way, we mentioned that last year, B'Kiv Eger says on this Mishnah that it's important for the husband to prepare the candles. He should, again, because it's not only her mitzvah, it's also his mitzvah, so he should help by helping prepare the candles. But says that Rashash, it's specifically talking about a rare situation in which a woman finds herself not lighting, but lighting after the Zman. So again, if that's the correct interpretation, I'm not saying it is the right interpretation, it's just one theory, it takes a little bit of the symbolic punch out of it, but at least makes it more understandable. Why are we thinking that not lighting Shabbos candles is so severe? The answer is we're not talking about not lighting candles, we're talking about lighting after the Zman. So again, I don't know if doesn't seem like that's what the Gemara really meant, but if it would be true, at least it would help us understand why the Gemara is speaking about it so severe. Now, I want to shift gears, and I hope this will be something good, and point out that there's at least one other source, a very powerful source, I would say, in Chazal, that also treat these three as a unit, but from the positive perspective. Not the doom and gloom, you might die, even if that's intended to be exaggerated, but still, clearly, harsh statement. But the flip side of that, and the flip side of that comes in source number 4 and 5. The Gemara in source number 5 is interpreting the psukim, I should say the pasuk in source number 4. Source number 4 is the pasuk in Shmuel Aleph about Chana. And this is when Chana is, desperate to have a child, and she's making, something that she was, I don't think she was necessarily the first, and she certainly wasn't the last person, man or woman, to make a deal with God. Right? If you do this for me, I will do this. So in that context, this very impassioned, inspiring, raw tefillah that Chana has when she's trying to have a child with Hashem, so it tells us, the pasuk tells us, "Vatidor neder." Basically, she makes a deal. She makes a vow to Hashem, and she says, "Imra'o tireh ba'ani amasecha." She refers to herself. If you see God, the affliction, the suffering of your maidservant, she uses the term amasecha, and you remember me, and you don't forget es amasecha, and nasata l'amasecha zera anashim. And if you'll give me your maidservant a child, then I will, give him over to you, and I'll make him, a nazir, etc., etc. So the Gemara notes, and in case you missed it, I bolded it on the source sheet. The Gemara notes, it seems to be odd, that not only does she refer to herself as a maidservant, she does it 3 times. So whatever the reason that she uses that term, that's not our focus now, but, this pasuk could have been a lot shorter. Right? She didn't need to be repeating itself 3 times. So says the Gemara, source number 5, Amar Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Chanina, these 3 references to her being an amma, a maidservant, lama amar chana lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Why was she doing this? What was the point? So she says, so the Gemara says, you know, in a medrash, in a drush, basically, amar chana lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What was God saying to Hashem? Quote, Rabbi Nishalaylam. She probably said it with a Yiddish accent, I assume. Like a Yiddish mama, she's chana. Of course she spoke Yiddish. Rabbi Nishalaylam. Shlosha bidke misa barata beisha. There are three different, so to speak, tests that you've created for a woman that if she doesn't pass those tests, there could be misa. Of course, it's a reference to what we've seen. Ve'eluhain, nida, chala, v'adlaka saner. So until now, we're just focusing, so to speak, on the negative. But here is the pivot. Says Chana to Hashem, klum avart yalachas mehen. I'm careful in all three of these. Don't just look at the negative. If I don't keep them, I could get punished. On the contrary, these are mitzvot which I have been careful in. As a result, you should give me a child. In other words, what's the sense you get from the Gemara? That, you know, as we might have told our children once upon a time, if we haven't, we should, because I think this is it's true and good parenting message to give, right? With more opportunity and more freedom comes more responsibility, right? This is when your younger child says, how come I don't get to stay up late as the older child? Yeah, but he or she has to do more chores or has more homework or whatever, right? When you get older, those things are supposed to come together, right? That's an important message for us all to remember. And certainly at some point, kids have to hear that message, right? These things go together, opportunity and responsibility. So yes, it's true that on some level, these three mitzvos bear this huge responsibility to women, God forbid, again, even if it's intended to be more euphemistically. But again, we can't deny this straight language, the plain language of the Mishnah, right? This is a very serious avera, the kind that on some level, a woman could lose her life over. And yet, says the Gemara, Chana flips it, which is okay, maybe that's true. But that also means that a woman who is careful in observing these three mitzvos deserves the ultimate reward, not of death, b'shas leida, but the ability to bring life into the world, the greatest bracha that a person can have. So, in this sense, again, it's not taking away the stakes. It's just pointing out something which I think is true about a lot of things in Yiddishkeit, which is that it's the more potentially, you know, it's like Zelu Mazah, Hashem created the world in balance, right? The things which have higher stakes, it's not only in one direction, right? That wouldn't be fair, right? It's not, the very things that we could get punished the most for are also the things that we can get rewarded the most for. And therefore, another way of looking at these three is not, again, it's a personality. You know, certain people, you know, are more, you know, glass half empty people. So they're going to be thinking about this Mishnah the whole time. You know, oh no, oh no, oh no. I'm making challah. I better get this one right. Oh no, oh no. You know, again, there are people who, you know, this Mishnah feeds into that. And I think it's unfortunate, but it's not completely groundless. But another way, and I would say a much more healthy and inspiring and positive way, an equally authentic way to look at it, is that these three, again, for reasons which we don't yet fully understand, we're going to try to get to before the shir ends, don't worry. But for these three are considered, you know, of unique significance and unique significance to women. And therefore, if I'm not careful about them, a woman should say to herself, yes, that's, again, not the word. We're usually taught not to, like, start playing God's accountant and start deciding what's more and less important. But it's hard to see these sources and completely deny the fact that apparently these mitzvahs are considered of significant importance. And therefore, yes, a woman should, you know, remind herself of that, and that should spur her, I would say, to be more careful about these three mitzvahs in particular. But rather than just, you know, oh no, you know, being like one of those cartoon characters where the dark clouds are following you every moment, right? The sun is following you every moment. In other words, it's in the observance of these mitzvos which actually has the proportional potential to give incredible bracha to the world, and specifically bracha to women. So again, it doesn't change the stakes, but it looks at them in a much more positive way. Now, I mentioned that, please God, next week we'll try to take each one of these individually and see some of the halachos where this comes through, and then kind of reevaluate them all as a unit. But just for the purpose of today, very, very briefly, I want to just show you in sources 7 and 8 that what we mean here is not only, you know, esoteric metaphors. We're kind of a little bit, in Yiddish, it's in the luf. A lot of this has been a little bit in the sky, if you will, up in the air. But the concrete precedence that women are given is found here, and I give you two very early and very authoritative halachic sources for what does this mean. Again, we still will get to this. Is the next side of the page is all about why these unique mitzvahs, why these mitzvahs specifically speak to women. We're going to get to that, I promise you. That's the second half of the shiur. But one last point before we get to that, which is one of the, again, I can imagine this might not be the most burning question that everyone was having when you see this source, this Gemara, this Mishnah. We've discussed some of the more urgent issues already. But one of them, which I already mentioned, which is, again, if we want to be intellectually serious, we have to ask this question as well. What does it mean? Forget the why. But what does it mean to say that there's more of a burden on women on these mitzvos if we know that all three of these mitzvos are applicable to men also? So basically what I've kind of been saying, but I've been cheating because I didn't tell you how I knew it, but now I'm going to tell you how I knew it. Basically the way the Mefarshim, even in a halachic context, understand this concept, again, I'm not from a practical halachic level, is that, yes, of course, these are halachos that relate to men and women, and even in certain cases, there may be times where the man has to step up and take responsibility for it. But the main point of the Gemara is, even if both men and women are around, and let's look at it from the perspective, not of burden, and why should I have to be responsible? Maybe my husband should be. Let's look at it from a much healthier spiritual perspective, which is two people who would want to each do the mitzvah. Why should I let my wife do the mitzvah? I want to do the mitzvah. I want to light Shabbos candles. It's so beautiful, so nice. I got a mitzvah, right? We're going to have a big thing. You know, men across the world, unite. We're going to light Shabbos candles, right? I want to bake challah. I want to be in South Africa on a Thursday night with 20,000 other women and bake, you know, and bake challah. You know what? Why not? I mean, I'm just recommended, but I would not be one of those people. I would butcher it. But other men are very good bakers. I know some men are very good bakers. Some of them who have wives at the table right now. There may be others that I don't know about. So what do we mean by this? So says the Or Zeruah, for example, source number 7. He's talking about challah specifically. Afal pishi isa mishgal gala nasis tevel vasura bein la anoshim bein la anoshim. As we've been saying, of course, the halachos, which are that once you've created that ball of dough, you need to first separate some challah before you bake it. And if you don't, there's a big avera, and that avera applies to men and women equally. Miu, nevertheless, mitzvahs hafrashas challah, where it's underlined, al haisha ramya. That is to say, she has precedence. Hilkach afal pishi isa hishal ba'ala. Even if, for example, let's say you have a one-income family, so it was his money that, so to speak, or he was the farmer, it's his, technically, maybe you would call it his property, it doesn't matter. He, mashve shliach lahafrish chala, afilu shalomi das bala, ha mitzvah dida he. She is always considered to have precedence, even if he doesn't know that she's doing it. We view it as if a mitzvah, it's as if she would be the shliach in a sense, but she's always given the precedence to do this mitzvah. She doesn't need to ask her husband for permission or like that. We view it as mitzvah dida. And then he said it more kind of passively and in a way, but then he says at the end, I suspect Choshashani to go even further. That it's not even that you need to kind of even think about the husband and technically she's his representative. No, forget that. It's her mitzvah. Again, not it's her mitzvah that he couldn't do it. Not that it's her mitzvah that only she gets punished if you don't do it. But she is given precedence. She is the one who has the right of first refusal, or really who ought to do it. He doesn't say why, but we didn't get to the why yet. But just that's what it means. Not that it's only a mitzvah applicable to women, but that women are considered the ones who have the priority in doing that. And this is more explicit and more clear in source number 8, which is a comment of the Bach. The Bach was one of the earlier commentaries, also from Poland, on the tour and then in the Shulchan Aruch. But this is quoted, what I'm quoting you now is also quoted years later by the Mishnah Berurah. And he says, what does it mean that women are given the mitzvah of Neros Shabbos? Again, not that a man, if he lived alone, is not chayav in candles. But specifically, it means, Ein biyad, source number 8, Ein biyad ha'ish lidchos as ishto mi mitzvah zu. Right? Again, let's say a man says, I want to do the mitzvah. Why should you get to do that? I want to do it. Says the Bach, a man has no right. He cannot forcibly take this mitzvah away from his wife. Kaven den hanoshim muzharis bo yoser. Women are more obligated Tadli ki v'tavarech. She gets to light the candles. She makes the bracha. The lo hu. Now again, what does that mean? Musharos bo yoser. That women are more obligated. Again, it doesn't mean technically, halachically, a woman is obligated more than a man in the sense that a man wouldn't have to do it. Or if a man did light the candles, let's assume with his wife's permission, his wife said, I'm too sick, I can't get out of bed, someone needs to light candles, or something like that. Of course, that would be obligatory on a man, and the whole family would be yotze. It means in a normal situation where there's two healthy people who could each both do the mitzvah, she is always given halachic precedence. This is not just a hashkafa thing, and it's not just to make things harder on the women or guilt women or tell them they could get the severe punishment. There may be some of that, but it's also, and just as importantly, or if not more importantly, from a halachic perspective, which is always, you know, the rubber hits the road. The real test of anything in hashkafa is if it's expressed halachically. If it's only pie in the sky hashkafa, I'm not saying it's unimportant, but it's a little bit less. If that hashkafa then gets expressed in a concrete halacha, that's much more real and much more significant. So here we see what is the concrete or real halachic context, and that is that women are given precedence to this. Now, I'm not aware of any conversation about this when it comes to the laws of Nida, and I assume that that's for obvious reasons, that no one ever had a Havamina, that the man was going to take responsibility to be doing the checking, etc., to make sure that his wife is not a Nida. But it's more than that. I didn't put it on the sheet, maybe I should have, but that's not, again, I don't think anyone even dreamed of that. But there is a discussion, which you probably know, but it's worth repeating and reminding you in this context, is that based on a pasuk in Chumash, we learn that not only are women responsible to check themselves and prepare themselves to become tahor after they become a nida, but as I said, even though the halacha, the consequences of, God forbid, not being careful in that halacha, are equally severe for the man and the woman, and yet, does the husband ever know for sure that his wife is tahora? How does he know? He didn't check, and he's not at the mikvah. How do you know she went to the mikvah? Maybe she went out for coffee with a friend. Or, if you want to be less cynical, maybe she had a chatzitza on, nobody noticed. She forgot to take off a band-aid. There was no mikvah lady. Or the mikvah lady, you may have heard this before, they're not always so great. A lot of them are very wonderful and very dedicated, but it's an uneven quality, and not just in Ramat Beit Shemesh, across the world. It's a hard job to find good people to do. So women who do it and who can do it well are doing very wonderful work for the community. But let's say, how do you know? So the answer is, the Gemara tells us, based on the pasuk in Chumash about the laws of Nida, v'safra la, that this is a woman. It's a woman's responsibility to keep track of this. And midaraisa, she is believed not only for herself, but also her husband. And this is the premise, this is the source of Eid Echad Neman V'Isurim. How do I know I can go to your house and it's kosher? Because you told me it's kosher. How do I know? Did I see? And the answer is, if a person is a religious Jew and they tell you that something is mutter or something is asur, you have a right to believe them. That is a halacha with massive ramifications. And we learn that from the fact that the Torah trusts women when it comes to the laws of Nida. And every now and then you have cases, these are always unhealthy cases. Every now, usually of unhealthy OCD. Every now and then you have cases of a man who won't trust his wife. And every posek that I know, when they're in that situation, again, if it's really a mental health issue, they'll have Rachmanis on the husband for his mental health. But literally or figuratively, give him a pachim punim. You have no right. Not only because it's hurtful, but halachically you have no right to doubt your wife. The Torah, whether you trust her or not, the Torah trusts her. So again, there is this unique severity, but the halachic expression of this is that women are given significant precedence, again, in this area. And where, well, in Nida, again, I don't think anyone dreamed of the husband getting involved, in the checking process or anything, or in the counting process, per se, but in the other two, you might have. A husband might say, I want the mitzvah of taking it and giving it to the Kohen. I want the mitzvah of lighting the candles. The answer is no. This is your wife's mitzvah, the woman's mitzvah, and she does not have to give it to you. Okay, we have about 12, 13, 14 minutes left, and I want to now do the last part of the shir, which is to ask one question and hopefully give two possible answers. And that is, with all of that said, why? Why is there some unique relationship between these three mitzvos and women? Now, the truth is that on some level, the Gemara itself was trying to answer that a little bit in the beginning, but the Gemara was more focused on just the severity of the three. But why Dafka women? What is going on with that? And here we have basically two answers. I would say, again, in the spirit of full transparency, when I was learning this, it struck me as one being a little bit more negative. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's a little bit more negative. And one, to me, being, you know, clearly from a Chazal's perspective, to me, I think also much more positive and uplifting. But either way, I share them both with you, because these are both quoted in the sources. We won't read it inside, but if you look at source number 9, it's Rashi already on the Gemara. We didn't see that Rashi before. But Rashi basically quotes both of the two theories, both of the two theories. But rather than just see Rashi's quick reference to them, let's look at the primary sources. Okay, so the first approach, the one that's a little bit more negative, the primary source is a Medrash. It's source number 10. It's a Medrash in Bereishis. Says the Medrash, "Mipnei ma nitain la mitzvas nida." Right? Why are all the laws of nida given to a woman? Now, you could ask this question, or you could understand the question in two ways. You could understand the question that, well, maybe the husband should be involved and in charge of the, you know, fulfillment of the mitzvah. Or you could also ask the question, why did Hashem biologically create women in that? I mean, we know that nowadays this is not such a given, but that's kind of horrible. I hope we all agree on. I became a bigger feminist in the last few months than I probably ever was my whole life. Like, this war against women is so terrible. Like, women have children. The idea that people can rob women of what it means to be a woman, to me, is just obscene. But let's not digress. But why is it that Hashem created the world in such that it's women who have this biological reality, and women have this halachic responsibility? Says the Gemara, says the Medrash, you know why? Yidei sheshavcha damo shel Adam arishon, lefichach nitan la mitzvas nida. It all goes back to Chava, in the first great sin. Right? It's true that the snake convinced her, but she could have just, you know, done it and left her husband alone. She was unwilling to go through it alone, and therefore she tricks, manipulates her husband into doing the sin as well. And as Chazal tell us, the Medrash is clearly assuming that until they ate from the Eitz Hadas, they never would have died. Death was brought into the world when they ate the fruit from the Eitz Hadas, whatever fruit exactly that was. And therefore she spilled, as it were, Adam's blood. She caused Adam to die. L'fichach nitan la, she got the mitzvah that relates to blood, to Nida. Ma nita in la mitzvah chala. Why are women are more responsible for the mitzvah chala? Again, goes back to Chava. Aide shekilkala es Adam harishon shahaya gemar chaloso shela olam. Right. If bread is, so to speak, the staff of life, so Adam, if you will, is the essence of human life. And again, euphemistically, poetically, metaphorically, Adam is referred to as, you know, the chala. Again, a chala, we said, is the Torah refers to chala in the is reshit, like that first gift you give the Kohen. So Adam is the Reshit. He is the first and the paradigm of all mankind. And because by her giving him, again, from the Eitz Hadas, she was Makalkel Adam, either it means causing him to die, and or because we know the Pasuk tells us that as a result of the sin, men are told you're going to have to work hard for a living. It's not going to be so easy to be a farmer, and the earth's not going to be, you're not going to just be able to pick fruit off the tree and eat. You're actually going to have to work very hard, and the earth will not always yield the produce. So one way or another, you have been mekalkel, if you will, the challah of Adam. So too, therefore, you have the mitzvah of challah. And lastly, if neiman nitan la mitzvahs ner Shabbos. Again, halachically, we assume this means ner Yom Tov as well. But why are women given the mitzvah of neros? Amar lehen. Again, same thing goes back to Chava. Aydei shekavsan nishmasa shel Adam arishon lefichach nitan la mitzvahs ner Shabbos. Right, as we this part we did see a little bit before. Right, we know that the human soul life is considered parallel to a ner, to a candle, and because you extinguished the light of the world by you giving this fruit to Adam and having him sin, you brought death to the world. Therefore, as an antidote to that, you're given the mitzvah of ner to, so to speak, bring back more fire, more candle, more light, more life to the world. Mitzvahs ner Shabbos. So if you were to sum up this Mishnah and approach number one, these three, again, it's somewhat esoteric, euphemistic, a little bit, to some extent, maybe convoluted, you even say, but Chazal are establishing that these three mitzvos correlate to the three negative ramifications of Chava's sin and what she induced Adam to do. I saw something, you know, again, if you give the expression cute, in source number 11, the Abu Draham, who was one of the lesser known Rishonim, so he points out that you could use the Chava's name to remember these three. It's a nutricon, right? Chava, Chet, Vav, Hey, Chala, Veset, that's the woman's menses, the period that she has over X number of days every month, and Hadlaka. So again, those three letters, again, it's a way of remembering it. It's a mnemonic, a nutricum is like a mnemonic. Chava is Chala Veses Hadlaka. So that's just a kind of cutesy little addition. But the basic approach number one is, as I say, is a little bit more negative, is, you know why women are given these three mitzvos? Because all of womankind, for all history, have some degree of responsibility to correct, to metakein, the chait of Chava. Now, as a side point, I only want to spend 1 minute on this because I want to get to the second approach, but it got me thinking, you know, this idea, again, a person could reasonably ask, why do I, as a woman, have to spend my whole life being metakein Chava's chait? Right? I should be responsible for my chait, not for Chava. But the truth is, whatever the justice of that is, it's not unique to women. There's a number of sources, and I mentioned two of them just very briefly. We don't have time to read them inside, but one is the Abarbanel, and the other is the great Hasidic thinker, Reb Tzadok HaKohen, source number 13. They both, for example, see the fact that men have to have a circumcision, a bris milah, as a tikkun for the chait of Adam. Right? He's not let off the hook either. He also did a sin. And it's not clear if it means the sin of Eitz Hadas or other sins, but the bottom line is all mankind, in this case, I mean gender specific, is also answering for the sins of Adam. You know, and if you would ask me, I would argue, again, I don't know if anything compares to childbirth, but it's not exactly like circumcision is the easiest mitzvah for a male to go through. And yet, why is that fair? The answer is, I don't know. But just like women are, for all history, womankind, capital W, not any specific women, but all of women are being metakein the chait of Chava, so parallel, all of men have a tikkun for the chait of Adam. Okay, anyway, that's all.
It goes well then that if you don't do it, your punishment is to die in childbirth, because that was the
right
punishment.
Good, very good, excellent, right, because the punishment there was that it'll be, it'll be the pain of childbirth. So, yes, there, again, I think it fits very nicely. Again, it's not the most inspiring. I don't know anyone, you know, again, many women that I know, you know, consider those moments where they light their candles each week as some of the most uplifting and magical moments of their week. And I don't know any woman who would want to go into the candles each Friday night saying, Chana, you know, I got to be metakein for her chait again. You know, it's not the most inspiring way to go through any of these mitzvos. And again, I think there are many other sources about each of these three, certainly about the laws of Nida and of Neros, which are also equally valid and authentic sources which speak about, you know, the hashkafic beauty of Shalom Bayis and the role that a woman plays in that, which are much more uplifting. But again, I'm not here to deceive you. This is one approach. When it comes to these texts that refer to these three mitzvahs as a unit and being uniquely responsible for women, one approach for why that should be is because these three are a form of kapara, a tikkun, for chait of Chava. The second approach, if you look at the last three sources, we'll do this in the next few minutes to finish up, are found, again, Rashi alludes to this as well, but it's also in sources that are contemporaneous and even earlier than the Rambam, than Rashi in one case. When it comes to candles, source number 14, says the Rambam, Nashim mitzuvos al davar zeh yoter min ha'anashim. Again, we said, halakhali men theoretically could light, but women are always given precedence for Shabbos candles. Why? Again, one could look at this in a restrictive way. I don't think it would be the fairest way, but I guess theoretically, one would look at it as if the Rambam was saying a woman's not allowed to leave the house, the woman can't have a career. I don't think that's what the Rambam is saying. I think it is true that the Rambam is reflecting what was true for most of human history, which is the women didn't. But again, maybe it's easier for me to say as the man, but I really think a not only more charitable, but I think a better read of the Rambam is that the metzius, and maybe even the ideal, I don't want to go there, especially if it'll offend anybody, but certainly the metzius, if not the ideal, is for women to be the akeres habayis, to be the one who is the dominant presence in running the home. And therefore, this mitzvah, which as I mentioned before, even halachically, is viewed as a mitzvah on the home. Right? We don't say, for example, that when a woman is lighting, like this is something we mentioned last year, and it's a little bit of a halachic nicety and a technicality, but I'll repeat it for those, because if you appreciate it, I think it really makes this point strongly. We don't view a woman who lights Shabbos candles every Friday night as the shaliach for her husband or the shaliach of the adult children. As if, because what would that mean? That would mean that all of us have individual mitzvos. I have a mitzvah to light candles. My wife has a mitzvah to light candles. My adult children have mitzvahs to light candles. But one of them, in this case, my wife, will be motzi us. That's actually not what's happening. It's that there's a mitzvah on the house, a mitzvah on the family, a mitzvah on the unit. And who is the best representative of the unit? The woman of the house. It's not that she's being motzi me or I be motzing her. The family needs to light candles. The home needs candles. And who represents the home better than anybody? The wife. Now you could say, again, if one was looking to be negative, you could say, well, since Nebuch, the woman, is not allowed to leave the house, not allowed to da-da-da-da, so, but I guess certainly not the most charitable way to read the Rambam, but I don't even think it's a fair read of the Rambam. I think, again, what the Rambam is describing, and again, it's not only the Rambam, but the Rambam is describing is, again, her presence is not a coincidence. The fact that women, for most of history, played that role is because there was a positive vision of the role that a woman would play in building a home. And therefore, since this is a mitzvah on the home, it makes sense for her to have priority. The source number 15... the Gaonim, again, this is even before the Rishonim, even earlier, the Gaonim is the period right after the Gemara. So there we have one Gaonic source, which basically makes the same point when it came to Challah. And that is, Hamina Ga'ola Mashah Nashim Ofos V'Isa Mesura Lehem. And therefore, the Chachamim told her that she should do the mitzvah. That is to say, again, he says in the Metzias, again, it could be that the man is baking. Again, I don't know if that was, you know, it's not that common even now, I think, in most families, and it certainly, I don't think, was common for most of human history. So who was doing the baking? Whether it was the Shabbos challah, or just that you should have bread, because most of human history, people subsisted primarily on bread. Who was baking that bread? So in most cases, there was no bakery. In most cases, the woman of each home would bake. So again, because this is her area of responsibility, so the Rabbanim said, yes, theoretically the husband could do the mitzvah too. He's also obligated in it if the mitzvah is not, if the mitzvah is violated. But once it's her area of responsibility anyway, again, I think the way I would see it in a more positive and charitable way is the Chazal said, if the women are responsible for it anyway, if they're doing it anyway, why not give them this mitzvah to uplift it and add a spiritual dimension? It's not as if they weren't going to do it anyway. And if there has to be a mitzvah, which there is, and they're doing it anyway, it makes more sense, since she's anyway the one who's taking primary responsibility for it, give her the primary opportunity and responsibility to not only do it in Metzius, but also to add the spiritual dimension to it. And again, the Bar Tanur in source number 6 makes this point as well about both. He combines them. As I say, you know, Chala and Hadlakas Haner, Tzarchei Habayis Hein, because these things are, again, you need light, you need to be able to function as a home, you need basic food to eat, and basically who runs the house? The answer is simply, as we all know in any good Jewish home, the mother, the wife. And therefore, that's why this mitzvah is given to them. So these three mitzvahs, I should say. And again, Nida, again, no one really seems to discuss that, because I guess it just seemed to be both, you know, obvious for Tznius and other reasons that that's going to be primarily the responsibility of the wife or the woman on for her own body. So I think these, again, to sum up, what we saw is this very fascinating and curious coupling, if you will, grouping of these three mitzvahs. Again, all on some lower level obligatory on men and women, and yet on some higher level, women are given unique precedence in fulfilling the mitzvah, again, which is a proxy or a Rorschach test for how you look at all mitzvahs. Are they a burden or an opportunity? So if you look at all of mitzvahs as a burden, then this is three more things I have the unique burden of. But men and women hopefully don't look at a life of Torah mitzvahs that way. We look at it as an opportunity. And women are given the opportunity, even before their husband, whether their husband likes it or not, to be the ones primarily able to discharge these obligations and fulfill these mitzvahs, even though there are mitzvahs that are relevant to the men as well. Again, for reasons that are hard to understand, although we did see some attempts to explain it, even if it's not meant to be literally taken as actual culpability of death, but there is this, you know, very graphic and you know, painfully unforgettable expression in the Gemara of women dying in childbirth because of these three. And even though, again, I think it's clear that it was not meant to be taken literally, it's clearly very, very significant. And, you know, can't be the significance of that expression shouldn't be denied, even if it's not intended to be taken literally. And then we also discuss, you know, why, you know, childbirth being, again, a dangerous situation, and therefore, so to speak, Hashem exploits that if we, God forbid, would deserve some severe punishment. And lastly, we saw, and I think maybe most importantly, we saw two different theories as to why Dafka, these three, might be uniquely associated with women. And again, one is a little bit more from a negative perspective, not negative about any one individual woman, other than maybe Chava, I guess. We're still kind of criticizing her all these years later. But she really, really messed up, not only for herself, but for Adam as well. And therefore, we are, you know, women for all history are trying to be metakein on some symbolic way. The chet of Chava, the same way that, according to some sources, men have to be metakein for Adam's chet. That's a little bit more of a less inspiring way. And then what I would like to think is the more inspiring or perhaps more positive approach, which we saw from the Rambam, it's also mentioned in Rashi and in other sources, is that these are three mitzvos which on some level represent the structure of family life or home life. And since women are considered to be the dominant personality and the leaders of the home and the family, therefore these mitzvos which represent the home and the family are given to her as a primary responsibility and given precedence for that. Okay, that's what I have for you this week. Imer Tashem, we will continue with a little bit, as I say, more detailed analysis of each of these three mitzvos, as well as kind of revisiting the three as a unit with a new theory, please God, next week.
Thank you.